Lord has given me a gift. Only one. I am the most complete fighter in the world.
Hello and welcome back to Adkins Undisputed, the most complete Scott Adkins podcast in the world. I'm your host, Mike Scott, on this journey through the career of one of the most exciting action stars of our time. This week, we're taking a look at 2014's The Legend of Hercules, directed by the great Rennie Harlan of Die Hard 2 and Long Kiss Goodnight fame. And to join me for that is this week's champion, a man who can only be described as the son of a god and a champion of humanity, Outlaw Vern. I was so giddy to get to talk to Vern, someone I've looked up to for years. We have a good time talking the movie, and of course Scott drops by to give us some insight on the making of the film. So, let's get into The Legend of Hercules.
I give you Hercules!
Gave this as a parting gift to my father. I want you to have it.
The peace between our houses will be sealed when my heir, Prince Iphicles, will take the princess of Crete to be his wife.
Doesn't matter where we go, we shall escape them.
I understand you're having some trouble with the arrangements we've made. You sail to Egypt tomorrow.
I wish you endless victories in the battlefield, brother. Because if you return here, I will kill you.
Your destiny will take you further from love than you can imagine.
Tomorrow, Hercules will be but a memory.
I cannot bear it. I know what's in store.
No, you do not.
I will not stop until I've returned to the princess.
Tonight, we fight for our lives!
How will you offer these people their salvation
when you cannot even save yourself?
Where is your strength now, half-god?
Hercules, you are the son of Zeus. Embrace your father, and you will discover powers that you never imagined.
The Legend of Hercules is one of those weird times when two competing films were being made at the same time. Over at Paramount, they were also producing a Hercules film starring The Rock. Millennium and Lionsgate attempted to get this one out sooner, as usually the first film out of the gate tends to be the more successful. It never fails to amuse me when something like this happens. Think Deep Impact and Armageddon, or Dante's Peak and Volcano. In any case, it didn't matter, as The Legend of Hercules was both a critical and financial failure, while The Rock's joint was relatively successful. Legend of Hercules only pulled in $60 million on a $70 million budget and was mostly savaged by critics with a 5% Rotten Tomatoes score. Although, almost uniformly, the reviews cite one thing as the highlight, one Mr. Scott Edward Adkins. Honestly, as you'll hear when I talk to Vern, Legend of Hercules isn't that bad. It's not next-level cinema, but Harlan brings his usual eye for action, and it has some impressive set pieces. Adkins and Spartacus's Liam McIntyre are both highly entertaining to watch, and the film moves fairly quickly. It's kind of a perfect Sunday afternoon dad movie, to borrow a line from my friend Anthony King of the Cult Movies podcast. The film tells the story of Hercules, played by Twilight's Kellan Lutz, the son of Zeus and a mortal woman, as he challenges Adkins' evil king Amphitryon and learns of his true heritage as the world's first superhero. It also stars Strike Back's awesome Roxanne McKee and Vikings' Gaia Weiss, as well as Jonathan Schaech doing a thing. This seems like a good time to kick it over to Scott to see what he has to say about making the film. All right. So, 2014, we get The Legend of Hercules. Now, the first big, just from a Hollywood practical standpoint, question I have for you is, when during the process of this movie did you and the other people making the movie become aware that The Rock was also making a Hercules movie?
Oh, I think they knew that that was happening, and it was a case of, I don't exactly know why it happened this way, but I think Millennium were probably planning on a Hercules movie. And then when they heard The Rock was doing it, probably fast-tracked theirs, because you don't want to be come out after that. But I think it was kind of coincidental that two of movies like that were being made at the same time. So they wanted to get on with it as quickly as possible, so that I can't remember which one came out first now, but we knew about it for sure.
You did. Legend of Hercules came out first. That came out the first part of the year, and then the Rocks one came out afterwards. You're working with Renny Harlin. How did this come about? How did you actually end up on this movie?
I was actually really trying hard to get into the Rocks one, because the graphic novel of the story that the film was based on, there's a character in it that looks exactly like Boyka, and he's the real warrior. He's like, he's a mute. He doesn't speak, and he's got the mohawk. Looks just like Boyka in the graphic novel. But anyway, that didn't go my way. So did the other one. But, you know, it's okay, because I don't know. I wouldn't say that one was better than the other, to be honest. They're kind of equal.
I agree with that. I think there's, and I got to be honest with you, I know exactly which character you're talking about, because I read that graphic novel before the Brett Ratner Rock one came out. And I feel like you get a lot more to do in this one. You know, you actually end up being, I remember when this came out, it made me so happy, because I read so many reviews, some good, some bad, but almost every single one of them that I read, like, sort of singled you out as the reason to watch this movie. And so what was it like actually working with Renny? I mean, you got a legend. We got the guy who made Die Hard 2. We got the guy who made Long Kiss Goodnight. Like, what's it like actually working with Renny Harlin?
It was great working with Renny. He's a lovely person. He's got a huge personality. He really loves his actors. Every weekend he would hold a dinner and all the cast would go out. And he's a great raconteur and would tell these stories about all the previous films he's worked on. He loves a good drink. And it was a really wonderful experience working with him. He's a fun guy to be around. And everything you do is just fantastic and amazing. And he's a real positive person. And yeah, he knows how to frame a shot and compose a shot and everything. And, he's done some amazing movies, amazing stuff. Bloody hell, Cliffhanger. What a film that was. The Long Kiss Goodnight. Got some amazing films in his past. So it was a pleasure to work with him, and I had a great experience with him. And for me, with the character, you've got to know what sort of tone the movie is. Whenever I'm doing a movie, the first thing I'll ask the director is, well, what's the tone of the film? Because only he can really tell you. And, you know, it's like an action fantasy adventure. So I thought to myself, well, this character, I'm going to have fun with him. He's the bad guy, and it's got like a very Shakespearean vibe to it. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to go a bit big with the guy and have fun with some of these lines and try and chew up a bit of scenery. And I think, I came out of it in a positive way because of that, because I understood what the tone was.
Yeah, you and another actor in the movie who I am also a fan of, Liam McIntyre, you guys are the two that really seem to you knew what the movie was, and you both, and you're both just so dynamic anyway. I will not, for me, I will not say anything about, I think Kellan Lutz did what he was supposed to. He was the lead, he was the hero, but certainly I think the two of you get to kind of come across as the most memorable characters because you guys are both just so dynamic, and you really stand out. And it was nice to see you like be full scenery chewing villain in this. I mean, you're, and I don't mean this in a negative way at all. I mean, it is a complete compliment. You are a full like comic book super villain in this movie. And I think it's absolutely terrific.
Have you ever heard, Michael, of a British comedy show called Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson?
Oh, you better believe I've heard of Blackadder. I've seen all of Blackadder. I grew up on Blackadder. I love that show.
Okay. Do you remember Stephen Fry in Blackadder, Melchett?
Yep, absolutely.
Now think about me in Hercules, and you can see where I got the voice. Yeah, Blackadder.
Yep. Yep. I absolutely. Stole it from him. I wouldn't
Hercules.
Have, I wouldn't have put it together, but now that you say it, I totally see it.
Yeah.
And I think it's great. And you know, again, this is one of those things. You're working with Rennie Harlan. Who's gonna say no to a Rennie Harlan movie?
Yeah, and I also had a great relationship with Millennium at the time, you know, coming off Ninja and the Boyka movies and all that stuff, and still do. How strange for me to be playing Kellan's dad when, you know, we're only like 10 years apart or something.
It was a little bit strange, but I think that's kind of one of those things, again, that you just sort of look at and go, well, it's a big, weird fantasy movie, and I certainly know for me as a fan, I'm like, I don't care if you're playing his dad or, frankly, play his great-grandfather for all I care. If it gets you in the damn movie, like, that's all I care about. I just want Scott Adkins in the movie. But, you know, and this was an interesting time for sort of, there was a point where everybody that was in a Twilight movie, they were trying to turn them into big stars. You know, Kellan had a couple of big action roles. He was in Expendables 3. Ashley Green had a couple of big starring roles and stuff. And it's like, sometimes I do feel like maybe not everybody is meant to turn into Anna Kendrick or Robert Pattinson the way some of those, you know, people did from Twilight. But like I said earlier, you know, I think Kellan does exactly what he's supposed to do. And I think he works great with you in this because as the villain, you get to be the big comic booky villain and he has to sort of be the stoic hero. And you guys get to play off one another sort of doing it that way. Whereas if you contrast that to The Rock's version, then nobody in that movie is going to be The Rock. Like, you, there's nobody you can cast that's going to be able to just not be The Rock. And so I do think they work nicely as movies that came out the same year because it's just, they're just so different. And I agree with you. I don't think.
Yeah. Kellan is, he's a lovely kid. He's got a very good heart. And he is a specimen. You know, he's tall, blonde, beefcake. Just what they wanted for Hercules. So, you know, he was nice kid. It was fun working with him. We had a good fight at the end as well. And he worked very hard on that. He worked very hard on the whole film.
Well, and that is the one thing I will say about the movie above and beyond everything else is, you know, you're back working with the Alpha Stunt Bulgaria guys. Borislav Ilyev is doing the fight choreography. And that last fight you guys have is, as you'd expect from choreography by Ilyev and just working with all the Bulgarian guys, it's a terrific last fight. It's really, really well done. And we have talked in the past about sometimes people are willing to put in the work and sometimes people aren't. Kellan looks like he put in the work in this movie. Like, he looks like he put in the time and put in the work.
Oh, yeah. He definitely was in great shape. Bobby, the main fight coordinator from Alpha Stunts there, it was his idea to come up with the little hole in the sword that I had so I could swing it around my thumb. Now, that guy's so smart. And that look was a great piece of cinema. I could hit with the sword, and as the sword was blocked, it would let go with my fingers and it would spin around my thumb. So I could almost go underneath, grab it again and come back with a slice the other way. Really inventive guys.
Yeah, it always reminded me of, when I watched it, and this is a good thing, it reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever seen Brotherhood of the Wolf, but Samuel LeBihan's swords in that. He can spin them around on his hands, and it's a very cinematic, very cool technique. And so I always get excited whenever I can see people who, you know, they can spin swords and the way that gets incorporated into combat.
Yeah, man. It's cool.
The Legend of Hercules was unfortunately another in a line of failures for Harlan. The man who made A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Die Hard 2, and Cliffhanger is a long way from his heyday. The 1-2 punch of box office failures that was Cutthroat Island and The Long Kiss Goodnight has meant he's fallen some pretty far heights. Now, before you start sending me angry emails, I think Cutthroat Island is a lot of fun, and Long Kiss Goodnight is an absolute action classic. It's Shane Black at his finest, and Gina Davis and Samuel L. Jackson friggin' rule. It's got one of my favorite kiss-off lines ever in a movie. But that doesn't change the fact that audiences didn't show up for them. Harlan rebounded with the relatively successful and awesome Deep Blue Sea, but that was followed by arguably his biggest disaster, the Stallone ego project Driven. Since then, he's had a few movies get wide release like Mindhunters and 12 Rounds, but has slowly headed more and more to the DTV realm. For the last few years, he's actually been in China making glossy star vehicles like Skip Trace with Jackie Chan and Johnny Knoxville, the fantasy epic Legend of the Ancient Sword, and the Nick Chung star Bodies at Rest, which I haven't actually seen, but I've heard pretty good things about. Currently, he has The Misfits starring Pierce Brosnan set to release in 2021. I'm not saying this to bag on Harlan. I love most of his films. Hell, I even defend Mindhunters and Driven more than any reasonable person should. I just say it to give you some context as to the world in which Legend of Hercules was released. 15 years earlier, a big-budget fantasy epic based on Hercules, directed by Harlan and starring an in-demand young actor hot off a teen sensation franchise that shattered records, should have been a slam dunk. In 2014, it wasn't even the best Hercules movie of that year. All right, enough of that. Let's bring on this week's champion. He's the man who taught me and several other people that action movies deserve to be treated with the same thought and care as Oscar dramas, and he's been a constant inspiration for me doing this show. Let's talk to the amazing Outlaw Vern.
So what are we waiting for? Bring me your fucking champion.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I have to be honest, I am absolutely ecstatic to have this week's champion. He is somebody who needs absolutely no introduction. If you listen to this show, you 100% read his work and follow what he does. He was a big inspiration for me starting this podcast. His book, Seagullology, was one of the big inspirations for me to do this podcast. Primarily because of the way he approached the work of Steven Seagal. I wanted to take that same approach to the work of Scott Adkins. It is the one, it is the only, Outlaw Vern. Vern, how are you tonight?
I'm great, thank you. That's very, very flattering. I appreciate that.
Well, I mean, you are kind of the you know, I'm not going to sit here and just give you platitudes all night. I don't want to embarrass you, but... you know, I think it's important to give credit where credit's due. You are one of the big inspirations for you know, this little group that's sort of formed that we kind of call Action Twitter. I feel like your work is sort of one of the flashpoints for that group to have sort of formed, because you take these movies seriously in a way that I think a lot of other critics and a lot of other film writers and film Twitter does not. And that's something that has, I think it's fair to say, been a big inspiration to a lot of us. I know it certainly has been to me.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very nice of you. There definitely was a time a long time ago when I would see other people writing about stuff like straight to video movies I had written about for years and in like larger, you know, with larger audiences than me and probably getting paid more than me. And I would think like, you'd grumble to myself. So, feels very good to be given credit, whether or not it's deserved. So,
oh, it's deserved. I mean, you know, I remember way back when you were still at Ain't It Cool, and how much, you know, and we'll talk a little bit about your background with Action and Adkins and stuff like that. But way back then, you really championing Scott Adkins films, and I was also kind of with you on that wave of like discovering him before a lot of other people did. So I was always very much like, yes, I'm loving to see this, because I feel like there's this dude that I know about and I know how awesome he is and nobody else knows who he is or how cool he is. And, yeah. And so it was really, you know, I'd read your work before that, but that was really when you started talking about DTV and especially, you know, Scott's films and Regeneration. And, you know, you were one of the biggest champions of Blood and Bone, which I think is just absolutely a classic of the genre. You know, that was when I was like, all right. Vern and I are simpatico. We are kindred spirits. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
I like to brag that, when I reviewed Universal Soldier Regeneration, I'm pretty sure it had not gotten any positive reviews until I wrote about it, which is crazy. But like every review I found before mine was just kind of writing it off as if they hadn't watched it, you know. So I feel very proud, because I still think that's just a masterpiece.
Well, and your review is actually a big sway for me, because if I remember right, I think it came out before the Blu-ray came out, or at least I had seen you on social media talking about it. And so I actually blind bought it. And being a diehard Van Damme fan, as much as I am, I don't always blind buy Van Damme films, especially later era Van Damme films. Yeah. But I blind bought that one and was just absolutely, you know, I mean, I've been pretty upfront on this show that John Hyams has become one of my very favorite directors. In fact, at this point, if I had to rank directors, I've always been very much Sam Raimi, John Woo tied for first. That I can never, in my heart, I can't decide which one I love more. At this point, I probably got to put Hyams as number three. I mean, nothing right now, no director is working right now that excites me more than if I see John Hyams has a new movie coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as I always do with everybody on this show for the first time they're on, I don't need Vern's life story, but I do always like to ask, when did action movies become your thing? For some people, you know, it was like me when they were kids. Other people came to it later. When did action movies really become a thing for you?
I would say a little later. When I was a kid, I was absolutely into movies in kind of a weird, little bit of a weird way, where like, you know, like I saw Star Wars at a drive-in, and it was probably a few years after it had come out. And
hey, me too. That was my earliest memory, seeing Star Wars at a drive-in.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, not only did I play with the Star Wars action figures as Star Wars, but I have this memory of me and my brother setting up a white box lid and like some Fisher Price Jeeps and stuff, and then having C-3PO walking around in front of the screen like he was the movie. We were like playing drive-in. So, and I would, you know, and I was like the kind of kid that would like cut out newspaper ads for the movies I was waiting for and all that kind of stuff. But at that time it was just any, you know, all kinds of movies. And because I mostly saw action movies in the 80s on video, I don't really remember the timeline of exactly when I first saw like Stallone and Schwarzenegger movies and stuff. Like it might've even been, I wonder if I even saw Kindergarten Cop and that kind of stuff, like Twins. Like I know I saw those in the theater, so I might've seen those before I saw Terminator and all that kind of stuff. But so the one that I remember being monumental for me first was Die Hard. And obviously I don't need to go into why that's a great movie, but I think you'll remember, but a lot of people listening are probably too young to know that Bruce Willis was like a gigantic figure before he was an action star. And so like as a kid, like my whole family would watch Moonlighting together. And I feel like I was programmed as an American male to believe that the coolest guy in the world is like a smart ass guy wearing sunglasses who sings oldies and stuff. So
I will still remember, I still remember clear as day the scene, and I think it was probably the first episode of Moonlighting when Cybill Shepherd is walking away and Willis starts singing, "There she was, just a walking down the street." Like exactly. I mean that is, you're right in that a lot of younger people, and especially people now who only know him as the guy who you have to like poke him to know he's awake in movies most of the time. Yeah. Like he was a hurricane of charisma on Moonlighting. I mean, he just was absolutely unbelievable on that show.
Yeah. And to give you an idea of how cool I thought he was as a kid, I have this memory of going to, my mom took me to this place to get my hair cut called Tina's Salon, and we would get our hair cut by Tina herself. And I remember bringing her photos of Brutus the Barber Beefcake from WWF and Bruce Willis and saying like, "I want to look like this." And so she cuts my hair, and at that age, I didn't understand that it didn't look the same because I didn't have a receding hairline like those guys. And Tina wasn't about to shave my hairline to look like that, you know? And that's before Die Hard. So that's how I look at the guy. And then I go see Die Hard with my family, and it's like this masterpiece of action. And he's still that funny, but also he's jumping off a building with a, you know, with a fire hose tied around his waist. And so that kind of, that was huge. And then really what made me lifelong action guy, I think, was really everything that happened in the 90s with, starting with, I remember just after graduating high school, a friend of mine named Richard took me to Scarecrow Video here in Seattle, and we rented The Killer. And he said, "This guy is supposed to be the Sylvester Stallone of Hong Kong." I remember him, that was what he said about Cheyenne Fat. And then, of course, we loved that. And then not long after that, I had a roommate that I remember bringing me this article and saying, like, "This guy, John Woo, he calls it bullet ballet, his movies." And like, I'm like, "Oh, I know that guy." And we went to a double feature of Hard Boiled and Bullet in the Head, which of course was mind blowing. And then around that time, it was just like everyone I knew was like discovering Jackie Chan and Jet Li, and we were just trying to get any movie we could find along those lines. And then, I remember this, another roommate had a friend that did Kung Fu, and I remember him bringing over all the Bruce Lee movies, which I hadn't seen at that time. So he kind of gave me my lessons in Bruce Lee. And then I was watching the Van Damme and Seagal movies that were coming out and backtracking and seeing the ones that I had missed before. And so by that time, there's no turning back, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, you know, I've told this story before. I went to see a midnight screening of Bullet in the Head at this rep theater here in Salt Lake. And it was clearly an audience of people that thought they were seeing a Jackie Chan movie. And so they kept laughing through Bullet in the fucking Head of all movies. Like I was hopping mad. I still to this day get mad about that. But I mean, that's you know, those are 90s action, really. I know a lot of people have a lot of 80s nostalgia, but for me, I'm really much more about the 90s action, because that's really when we did get, you know, even the when I think of movies that are like 80s action movies, they're really more 90s, like Bloodsport, for instance. Yeah, yeah. It's in, technically it's an 80s movie, but it really feels more akin to the 90s action movies. You know, Above the Law, Hard to Kill, like those are all much more in line with what we would see in the 90s than what we were seeing in the 80s. And so I'm with you. I think that was really kind of the sweet spot. You know, I always sort of tell people, kind of from Point Break to Face Off is really, I think, the sweet spot for big budget Hollywood action. We were getting just so many great big budget action movies during those years. And then the year after Face Off, we get, I can't remember if it was 98, but I kind of feel like when we got Armageddon, that really shifted. Yeah. That was like a shift to these big budget CGI blockbusters that we get now, many of which I love. But that was really, I think, the sweet spot for action movies, especially on a Hollywood scale.
Yeah, that was also pretty much exactly the starting point of the starting to not be able to tell what is going on in action scenes, which had never occurred to me as a problem before until seeing like Con Air and Armageddon. People will get mad if I say anything negative about Con Air, but that was my experience, was watching it and going, what the hell is going on? And why is this a close up of the wheel of the plane instead of, you know, so.
Well, and I think it's fair to say, look, I love Con Air, but I don't, when I think of Con Air, I think of, you know, what's wrong with him? My first guess, a lot. I don't actually think of the action scenes in Con Air as being the appeal of that movie. The appeal of that movie is actually, believe it or not, the appeal of that movie is at the script level, right? The dialogue in that movie is just exceptional. But the action is not, and it's so funny because now I look at Simon West and I see some of the stuff that Simon West does now, and I'm like, oh, well, he actually knows how to shoot action, because it's gotten so much worse. You know, you've got your rating on your site. I don't want to misquote it, but your action, like your shaky cam.
Comprehensible.
Yeah. Your action comprehensibility rating. Yeah.
Yeah. I retired that, but for a while it just seemed necessary to be like, who knows if you, it seemed like an important consumer service in a way. Like if you go to see an action movie and you can't trust that it's going to, that you're going to be able to tell what the hell is going on.
Well, in a world where Olivier Megaton exists, you really need something like that, right? Like, and I don't, you know, I try to keep it absolutely positive on this show, but Megaton's one that I can't just, especially again, because he gave himself that name. Like, his last name's Fontana. Come on.
I'm okay with the last name. Not with the last name. Did he do Colombiana, or was that somebody else?
No, I'm pretty sure he did do Colombiana. Okay. I'm sure somebody on Twitter, if we're wrong, is going to be sure to let me know, but I'm pretty sure he did.
Well, I kind of liked that one, but which the transporter he did, I did not like.
Yeah, I agreed. So I wouldn't be doing you as a guest justice if I didn't ask, so when did the love of Steven Seagal really develop? When did that become, I mean, how does one decide to write a book about Steven Seagal?
Okay, well, I honestly don't remember which one I saw first. People are always shocked that I wasn't in on it from the beginning. I definitely was a little late on Seagal, but what I remember is that I remember a guy kind of that I had a class with or something that I ran into, and he had seen On Deadly Ground in the theater. And he was like, it's incredible. You got to see this. He does this big speech at the end about the environment. And like, and this is a guy like on my wavelength where like most of the world was like, what an idiot. He's doing a speech about the environment. But we were like, can you believe that he has the balls to like go out and say this and put it in his giant studio action movie, you know? And so like, and so when I saw that movie, that was how I felt. Like I you know, there's a lot of bad mojo surrounding that movie we know now, but it's a movie that I absolutely love for the combination of the technical aspects of the big studio action movie are actually well done. It has a great score, like beautiful cinematography, and the story is completely ridiculous, but in a way that's really cool, I think. And like the politics of it seem to be not what he sincerely believes, but also are, you know, at the time were pretty correct and ahead of a lot of people. And, you know, like the speech that everyone made fun of is basically like what Al Gore ended up getting an Oscar and a Nobel Peace Prize for doing, a rough version. And so, there's just so much great dialogue and performances, and it's just like, you know, it's an amazing combination of badassness and absurdity and pompousness and so many other things that I think are fun.
It's got one of the all time great, this guy's a badass and he's going to kill you speeches from Arlie Ermey in it. I don't even remember much about that movie because I haven't watched it in years. I probably haven't watched it since it came out on video, but I still to this day remember Arlie Ermey giving that speech about how badass it's a classic. Seagal is.
Yeah. So I liked his other movies I'd seen, but that was what really made me interested, because I've always been a guy that likes like Billy Jack movies and stuff like that, where it's like it's action, but also he's saying something that I kind of agree with or that I feel like is unusual to put into an action movie. And so I loved that. And then at that time I was reviewing for Ain't It Cool News, and I had access to these straight to video or like video screeners for a video store. And a lot of them were straight to video movies. And so I ended up getting a bunch of those Seagal ones, like Out of Reach and Out for a Kill and stuff like that. And so I was reviewing those, and it was just so fun to analyze them and notice how much of commonalities they had between them that seemed like they were his obsessions that he was putting into all of his movies. And so I literally got to a point where I made a big chart where I listed the different, including just how badass is he and like the thing that the villain does to establish how cruel they are to their underlings, and then like political themes and stuff like that would be on one axis. And then down the other side, I wrote all of the movies that he'd done, and I made this little chart. And so eventually it occurred to me like that I should make a book called Seagology that was seriously analyzing that. And so I want it to be funny, but also I'm completely serious about that these are cool and interesting movies and worth digging into and not just making fun of. And so my goal really was this would make me happy if there was a book called that and it existed. And so I self-published it, and I really, there was definitely not a thought in my head that this many years later I would be talking to someone about it, but it makes me so happy to.
Well, and again, man, I cannot stress to you enough how much, because that was, as I hit my microphone, that was kind of my same thought process. Is I was like, I had the same thought about Scott Adkins movies, that they are interesting. And also, as I was watching so many of them, I was noticing all these threads of the people that he's worked with, from, you know, stunt people and second unit directors and stuff, and how really realizing that action in the 21st century runs through Scott Adkins. And he's like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon of 21st century action. And I really wanted to sort of start pulling all that together in the same way that you did with Seagal's movies. And yeah, one of the things I love about your book is there's not a hint of irony. Like, yes, it's funny because you're a funny writer, but there's not a hint of irony there. There's not like ironic attachment. You are still treating these movies with a respect and a scholarship while trying to be funny. And that's really, like I said, that's what I try and do here. Like, look, at the end of the day, legendary is legendary. Scott fights a giant CGI iguana. You know, I mean, it's not, there's only so much you can do with a movie like that, but I still tried to make sure that it's like, well, okay, but here's the interesting things about it. It's one of the first times, you know, he returned to China, and it's got him and Dolph working together again. And so that's interesting. And, you know, and kind of just the stuff like that, that I think is what makes these movies fun to talk about, because the reality is action cinema is a fairly small pond. And so there is a ton of crossover, and it's really interesting to start seeing how, you know, well, the reason Scott does the Guyver kick is because Yuji was the stunt coordinator on Special Forces, and he gave it to him as a passing down of the torch. Like, that shit's interesting. I'm sorry. If you're like a stuffy IndieWire critic or whoever, and you don't find that shit interesting, I can't help you. That stuff is fascinating to me.
I was happy to learn that from your podcast. The Guyver movies were the same guy that gave me the Bruce Lee movies gave me the Guyver movies. So.
Yeah, so, I mean, I love history. I love alpha stunts. And Koichi Sakamoto. Yeah. I can't talk. And I mean, that's the other way that this whole thing kind of came about. Is I went off on Broken Path on Twitter one day because I love that movie so much, and you know, here we are. So that leads us to my next question before we get into the actual movie that we're going to talk about, which is, and I know people, you know, you're such a prolific writer, people can go back and find your writing, but just for the sake of this podcast, when did Adkins first pop up on your radar?
You know, I actually went and checked just so I would be sure I had it right. It was Undisputed 2, and I watched it about a year after it came out in 2018 was when I reviewed it. You can look it up on outlawvern.com. It's weird. I mean, straight to video sequels were kind of my passion, especially at that time. So it's weird that it took me a year to get to it. But my sin was that I really hadn't caught on to Michael Jai White yet at that point. It was like I had seen him in, I think Exit Wounds is probably before that. And I just knew him as like the guy from Spawn and stuff. And so I was like, yeah, he's pretty cool, but I don't see why everyone always says he has to be the guy to play Blade or whatever. You know, people would always bring him up. But I wish I remembered who told me like, no, you got to see Undisputed 2. So another thing was the original Undisputed didn't really appeal to me much at the time. Like I loved Wesley Snipes in it, but I was disappointed in it as a Wesley Snipes movie and as a Walter Hill movie at the time. So I was just like, you know, not that excited. So then I see Undisputed 2, and of course it's incredible. And just, I love the idea of taking the villain and making him the hero. And so I went back and looked at my review and I did mention Adkins and his flying kicks and stuff, but it was really, I was more excited about finally getting, you know, getting a clue about how awesome Michael Jai White is. And then also about discovering Isaac Florentino, who I hadn't known about at that point. And just like, that was kind of my dream writing about straight to video action movies all the time was like, there's some, you know, I thought of him as being like the way drive-in movies were for like, or, you know, like Roger Corman had all those directors that were like, I'm making an exploitation movie, but I'm going to try to do something special with it. And I always felt like that should be the case with DTV. And then when I saw Murana, I realized that this guy existed, I was like, wow, the prophecy has come true, you know? So yeah, it was that. And then about a month later, I reviewed The Shepherd, which I haven't watched in a while, but I at the time at least liked it a lot more than a lot of other people seem to. But I remember watching it and I hadn't quite caught on to what Adkins looked like outside of being Boyka. And so I knew he was going to be in it. And I remember going, well, he's supposed to be the bad guy, but this guy is clearly the more awesome one. Like, why, you know, the henchman guy. And then I started to realize, oh, that is Scott Adkins. And in the review, I said that was the one bad thing about the movie was that he should have obviously been the main villain because it didn't make sense to have him as the sub villain. And I wrote down a quote that I said, hopefully Adkins will get some more respect one of these days.
Yeah, I mean, so, that was when Patrick Bromley was on and we did The Shepherd. That was our same thing, is why is he not just, like, why do you have two villains? Just make Adkins the main villain, because the other guy was not, I mean, he's a good actor, but
yeah,
there was no reason for there to be two villains. And you know, and I know part of that was they actually bumped up Adkins' role because Isaac and J.J. Perry wanted him to be a bigger part in the movie. It was actually supposed to be a smaller part. But no, I'm with you. The biggest flaw in that movie is that Adkins is the featured henchman, not the actual main bad guy. That movie's much better if it's all Adkins.
But I'm happy that I was asking for more respect for him. And here we are on a podcast that you've made, giving him the respect he deserves. So good job.
Well, no, good job to you, because, yeah, again, you were ahead of the curve on this, and I didn't have a voice at that point. I mean, I was barely even on the internet at the time. So, you know, God love you for people who can't watch, I'm cheersing Vern, you know, using that voice and that platform that you had to champion him, because he's very much somebody that warrants this, you know? So that takes us to the movie of the week, which is The Legend of Hercules. Now, folks, this one's going to be a little bit different because Vern had not actually seen this one until I asked him to come on this episode. And we have not talked, so I have absolutely no idea what his take on the movie's going to be. But we'll do our usual. So let's get started just with initial thoughts, Vern. What are your initial thoughts on The Legend of Hercules?
I would say that I am kind of a easy mark for the modern fantasy movies. I usually go see them at a matinee, and there's about five guys older than me in a giant, mostly empty theater, and I come out satisfied. And that happened with King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, the other version of Hercules with The Rock, the Robin Hood movie, if that counts, and you know, those type of movies. I usually like them even if they're really stupid. 300 Rise of an Empire, I actually think it's a great movie.
I argue that one's better than the actual Zack Snyder 300. I think the sequel improves. I think Eva Green is way better. I mean, she's a huge addition, and frankly, spoilers, because we spoil everything we talk about on this show, the horse charge on the boats just is so much cooler than anything that's in the original 300.
That's always the first thing I think of when I think about loving that movie. Either that or Eva Green kissing the severed head that she just created. So I love those kind of... to give a better example, like, I even liked the remake of Clash of the Titans that everyone in the world hates. Therefore, I feel like it doesn't mean that much for me to say, like, this was okay. I kind of enjoyed this. I didn't like it as much as most of those movies that I listed, but it was a completely, the fact that I didn't see it before means I was afraid it was going to be completely dull and incompetent. And it wasn't that at all. It's pretty, if anything, it's just a little too down the middle normal for me. But it was a decent story, you know. I had a semi-fun time watching it.
Yeah, I mean, so it's actually funny. I went back, because I just rewatched this last night in preparation for this, and I had only seen it once. And I went back to log it on Letterboxd and noticed that I'd given it 1 star based on the first time I watched it. And it's not a 1-star movie. I'm not going to say this is a masterpiece of cinema or anything like that, but it's not a 1-star movie. I ended up bumping it up to, I think, 2 or 2.5, because there's more than enough in this that I think is entertaining. And it turns out that guy, Rennie Harlan, kind of knows how to direct a movie, whether it works or not, you know, that I don't know. I must've been in a bad mood or something when I reviewed it the first time, because it's not bad. I think that there's some actors in it that are very good. I will be honest, and I was tweeting this last night as I was rewatching it. The biggest problem I have with the movie is again, I try not to be negative, but Kellan Lutz is a sentient block of wood. And I think there is a vacuum of charisma at the center of this movie that had somebody else been Hercules, I think we're actually talking about a movie that kind of rules in a lot of ways. But he's just, for me, he's very pretty. He's got dreamy blue eyes, but he's very dull as Hercules in this movie.
Yeah, I can't really argue with that. I don't think he's one of those just so bland they suck the life out of everything kind of roles, but also not the kind of guy that you want to be excited to watch him, wrestle a lion or whatever.
Well, the biggest problem I have is the main co-star in the movie is Spartacus's Liam McIntyre, who I actually think is a pretty charismatic and likable actor. And I honestly think if they had just swapped those roles, I know McIntyre's a little bit older, so you might have had to tweak the script a bit and stuff, but if they had just swapped... I keep hitting my mic. If they had swapped those roles, I think I know, at least for me, I am way more into this movie if Liam McIntyre's playing Hercules. Because even in this, the scenes where there... It was so funny because I was watching it with my wife, and when Liam McIntyre came on, I had forgotten he was even in the movie, and I was like, oh shit, it's Liam McIntyre. She hasn't seen Spartacus, so she didn't know. And I'm like, he's awesome. Yeah. And there was a point where they have a scene together, and she was just kind of like, it's really not fair to Kellan Lutz. Like, it's not fair because he's like stealing the movie out from under him. And so I think that's the biggest problem. But other than that, though, yeah, I mean, we'll kind of go through a little bit of the cast here, and we'll save Scott for the end because I think it's fair to say he's all in on this movie, and I love every second of it. But because we've also got, what I think is the great Jonathan Scheck doing a weird thing. I don't know how I feel about Jonathan Scheck portraying an Egyptian. I don't know his heritage. So I'm not, maybe he is Egyptian. Yeah. I don't know, but I certainly don't think of Jonathan Scheck being Egyptian and with the cornrows basically and stuff, but it's your eyes are still glued to him when he's in the movie.
Well, my experience with that is that I watched the movie and at the end I saw the name Jonathan Scheck and I was like, where was he in the movie? And this was a couple of days ago. And then today I was working on writing about it and to get me prepared for this podcast. And I was like, who did he play? I was like worried I'd be embarrassed when you started talking about his scenes in it or something. And so I Googled it and saw the picture of who he was playing. I'm like, holy shit, that was Jonathan Scheck. I did not realize it was him. Yet, if you haven't seen it at home, he has black cornrows and does not look like the guy I'm familiar with from Roadhouse 2 and the Prom Night remake.
Yeah, he's got black cornrows. He's got guyliner on. Jonathan Scheck already is fairly olive skinned, but it looks like they've got like bronzer on him or something. I mean, he's definitely not, but there's a lot of people that I feel like seem to understand the type of movie that they're in and are playing accordingly, which I always appreciate. I always understand, and some of that is just, I think also Rennie, I'm not sure has ever misunderstood the type of movie he's making. Now, I think audiences have sometimes misunderstood the type of movie that he's making, like Cutthroat Island, right? There's no question. That's the movie that Rennie wanted to make. And frankly, I am a big Cutthroat Island defender, so I'm fine with it, but clearly audiences at the time did not understand the movie that he was trying to make.
Yeah, he's a mysterious guy. So I think it's interesting that I think of him as kind of this old school legend because he did Die Hard 2 and everything. And then throughout his career, he always starts imitating what's popular at the time. And I don't really see other directors of his level from that time doing it as much as he does it. where like, did you, I think he did a, did he do a found footage movie? I think he might have. And he did a, he did a 12, I think it was 12 rounds, which I liked a lot. Has all this like shaky cam stuff in it. And he, but it's well done because it's Rennie Harlan and he has chops. But he, I remember on the extras on the DVD, he was talking about it like it was this new thing that he had invented to move the camera around more like a documentary or whatever he said. And then in this one, the case of this one, it's like he's got those, most of the movie does not look like it's trying to copy 300, but like the opening like 3D shot has all this like 300 type coloring, and he does all the speed ramping during the action, which I'm okay with, but it's obvious that he's imitating.
Oh yeah, he loves speed ramping in this movie. Yeah. This movie is speed ramped to hell, which I am not, much like you, I am actually not a speed ramping hater. I think one of the things with speed ramping is it guarantees that the action's going to be clean and clear, because it just doesn't work. You can't really speed ramp if you don't have clear action. So in a lot of ways, I like speed ramping. Speed ramp the hell out of shit. I prefer it over shaky cam. But, there's very much a, he's very much a director of not much of a personal style. You know, I think about something like Driven, which I don't really know, in spite of the fact that I feel like Rennie has always known what kind of movie he's making. I don't know how to really say, oh yeah, that's a Rennie Harlan movie. You know, I can watch an Isaac Florentine like, that's an Isaac Florentine movie. Rennie Harlan's not really that. You know, when I think of, for me, the ultimate Rennie Harlan movie is Long Kiss Goodnight. But that's really the last movie that he made that looked like that. I mean, if you look at the movies he's made after that, not a single one of them has that glossy, big-budget action style. I guess Driven kind of does, but it's got so much CGI. I mean, that he really fell in love with CGI in that. And then you get Mindhunters, which he's trying to replicate Seven, basically.
But I feel like he had a little mini section in his filmography with Mindhunters and Deep Blue Sea and then sort of The Covenant, but it wasn't as good. But it was like he suddenly became this master of like brain damaged studio movies that you could not believe they were doing weird shit that he had to have known was funny. And I don't know. I like that little period.
Yeah, no, I mean, nobody makes Deep Blue Sea better than he does. And I love Deep Blue Sea. Nobody makes that movie better than he does. There's no question in my mind about that. Any other director in that movie is unwatchable. But he knew how to do it. And, you know, and he was also smart enough in those things. He knows where the talent is in his movies, like Deep Blue Sea. You know, at that point, Thomas Jane wasn't much of anybody. And he's like, no, I'm going to make this guy the star. Why? Because he's Thomas Jane and he rules. And it's kind of the same thing here with Hercules, where it's like, well, Kellan Lutz is Kellan Lutz. So what am I going to do? I'm going to give Scott Adkins as the villain almost as much screen time because he's going to be, you know, charismatic and interesting and fun to watch. I mean, Rennie knows where his talent, where the talent in his movies is and knows how to use it.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, otherwise, you know, we would have had Driven with just Kip Pardue. He wouldn't have added Till Schweiger and Stallone. And I think we can all agree that Kip Pardue is not the reason that anybody watches Driven. All right, well, let's talk about some of the other things. What are some of your other, we'll talk about low points, but what are some of your high points for Hercules? What are some of the things?
You know, I don't quite think there was enough of it, but I liked that, unlike the rock version of Hercules, that they did have the sort of magical stuff in it with the lightning and I liked the goofy CG lion wrestling scene. And I think there was a lot of stuff that I don't know how intentional it was, but I got some enjoyment out of the way that his brother was such a just completely unlikable snivelly guy from the beginning, but then every time Hercules talked about him, he like had so much sympathy for him and wanted to work things out with him and stuff. But he just, the actor just played it like there was no chance of redemption for this guy. And you just want to punch him from the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, I do love a movie that like goes all in on the villains. Right. And just makes them, I mean, his brother is so sniveling and so shitty. Like, for the whole movie, you're just like, I'm going to be super happy when Hercules sticks a sword in this guy. And that's good because
yeah,
the whole point of this journey is, you know, it's Hercules 1.0. It's the Hercules origin story. Essentially, it's the Iron Man of the Hercules cinematic universe. And so it is good because we need to see Hercules go all the way down and then build himself back up, which I do think the movie does a pretty good job of that, so that he can get revenge on this sniveling little, or at least establish himself as the rightful hero of the story. And yeah, the brother being so sniveling just makes that so much easier to go with. And Liam Garrigan actually really does play the role to perfection. I'm a big fan of him from, this is actually, I have to shout out because I've talked about Strike Back on this show a bunch before. Both Liam Garrigan and Roxanne McKee are Strike Back alums. And I think Strike Back is one of the best action television shows of all time. So I love him from Strike Back, but he's so awful, not as an actor, but just as a, the character, is yeah, so awful in this, and I loved every second of it. I loved all of it.
And then I also got a laugh from that scene where he was talking to his mother, and it was like the one time when it seemed like maybe they were going towards making him be a sympathetic character, because he's kind of sad about that he's has this forced marriage, that he's forcing his brother's girlfriend to marry him, and he's kind of confiding in her about like, she doesn't love me, obviously, what am I supposed to do? And but then, and she, his mother is very loving to him, but then he suddenly says something about like how dad was married to you and then you learned to love him, and then she just completely does not sugarcoat it, just drops the hammer on him about like, no, I have never loved that piece of garbage, what are you talking about? And just completely destroys the guy's, her own son's entire image of his life, like, just it's so funny because she's like a good guy and you're like, what are you doing? But I mean, it was deserved, but it was not very motherly of her.
No, it was not. But she's, you know, and that's I one of my other high points is I do really like Roxanne McKee in this. I hate how she goes out, but I do love that she goes out, you know, the way she finally tells Amphitryon, Scott Adkins' character, no, he's not yours, he's the son of Zeus, suck it, motherfucker. Like, and you know, and it doesn't end well for her, but at least she gets to go out saying that, like no, my son, not yours, is a god, so fuck off. Like, and the way she delivers it is really, really very cathartic almost when she finally stands up to him, because again, the villains in this are just, they're bad. They're bad, bad people. And so it's nice to see them get their what for.
Yeah. The scene, I don't know if we should save this for the Adkins part, but the scene where he walks in on her having magical lightning sex with Zeus was amazing, because he's like, there was a good example of how funny he plays his character, that he walks in like laughing, holding hands with a mistress, like walking into the bedroom and discovers the queen with magical lightning, apparently making love to her. And then he starts running around yelling, like, where is he? Like he knows that somebody's been with his wife and he doesn't understand that it's an invisible god.
Well, and I love that you brought up, so one of my pet peeves, it's, I enjoyed the Brett Ratner notwithstanding. I enjoyed the Brett Ratner rock version, but I don't really enjoy my Greek mythology stories being grounded for the most part. Gods are such an inherent part of these stories, and so I really do appreciate that this one, I'm with you. I think they could have gone even more full tilt on it. But I do love after that, he comes running out and he's like, where is he? Somebody's been with my wife. Get the guards, you know, find him. And all of a sudden, like a bolt of lightning comes down. And it's like, even though he's like in denial until she tells him, it's like, oh, no, you know what just happened here. You know who was in your bed and you can't do shit about it. So, yeah, like I really enjoyed the God stuff this time really made me giggle. In a happy way. Anytime yeah. Hercules did something or somebody did something and it would rain or the lightning would come down and stuff. Like there's the scene where they've got Hercules shackled and he's like, Father, give me strength. And the lightning starts coming down and he's able to break. Like, dude, I am a sucker for that shit. Like, I am such a mark.
I loved the gimmick of him using the chains with the pieces of stone stuck to the end, swinging them around. And was obviously the movie was released in 3D. So it was very obvious that it was like a 3D gimmick, but it was a cool idea that it was using them like a mace or something.
Yeah. I mean, it just, there is a lot of stuff in this movie that, you know, I'm just, like you said, you know, you're sort of a mark for these fantasy movies, and I think there's a lot of dead time in this movie, but when the movie is firing, it fires. It really fires. I was kind of just giggling my ass off last night. I just had a big smile on my face while I was watching most of this movie. So what are some other high points? I know you've taken copious notes. I can see you looking at them. So what are some other high points for you?
Well, I liked that when he was sold into slavery as a gladiator, it wasn't the traditional like arenas that you normally see. It actually looked like an Undisputed movie, that he's in this kind of mud pit area. And I don't feel like those fights were great, but they had cool, like colorful villains that he had to fight against. And I'm sure that you would mention that Spencer Wilding was that one guy with, I forget his name. It was a cool name that he had.
I was actually, because we just recorded Green Street 3 a couple weeks ago. And so when Spencer Wilding came out and he's got that crazy hair and stuff. But the thing I love about Spencer Wilding is his face is just so distinctive, right? His face looks like it's carved out of granite. Like if they ever redid I don't know if he ever listens, which I can't imagine he would. I don't mean this as a criticism. If they ever redid a Frankenstein movie and they don't cast Spencer Wilding to play Frankenstein's monster, they are really missing out, because he would be perfect for it.
I think he did, but it was in a bad movie. I believe that Victor Frankenstein had him as the monster.
Well, let's look that up, because then I will be.
I didn't like that movie. I shouldn't say it was a bad movie. I personally didn't like it. But.
Well, given
the one guy,
you know, and that's one thing. Yeah. And I know I didn't want to get into this. We can take a little detour. But one thing that, you know, I do want to give you credit for and say, yes, he was monster in Victor Frankenstein. So there we go. Somebody had the idea. I'm not treading new ground here. You know, as a guy who wrote a book about, shall we say, not a great human being, I do always appreciate your ability to, because I, on this show, I'm very upfront. Like, not everybody that Scott's worked with has been a great human being. And I think it's important on us to not, as people with voices, mine much smaller than yours, to still note that at least. And so the way you've always reconciled loving Steven Seagal movies with who that person is has been very influential on how I reconcile this stuff. I just ran into it this week with fucking Jim Caviezel, who I have talked about at length on this show, being a QAnon nut. And it's like, God damn it.
I mean, I was always trying to convince people that Armie Hammer was the greatest.
Yeah, it just, And that's,
how do you tell people how great the Lone Ranger is now when it's got those guys starring in it? But yeah, it's hard. I definitely for a long time was deluded about how bad Seagal was, because I really, people would always say he was an asshole, and I just kind of thought that was what he was an asshole, but it seems that there was a lot worse than that. And I kind of started to get fed up with him just from hanging out with Putin and stuff before we learned more. And it's hard to deal with. Everyone has to figure out how they want to approach it. If you can't stand to watch something because a bad person made it, then I think that's completely understandable. But I also want to be able to hold on to things that I love that were, I know, made by like groups of people that are talented, or made by a person, you know, that maybe is a bad person, but they also happen to have created a thing that I love. And, you know,
that's the thing.
Yourself. Yeah.
Jim Caviezel can't take away Person of Interest from me. Right. You know?
Yeah.
Timothy.
For me, it's Highwayman.
Yep. Timothy Hutton can't. Oh no. I love Highwayman. I have been a big champion of Highwayman for a long time. Timothy Hutton can't take away Leverage or
I don't even know what's about him, but you don't have to tell me.
Let's just say they're doing a new Leverage series and Timothy Hutton's not in it. So there you go. And everybody has to make their own rules. And I say this just because people listening, I want them to always know that I'm always going to talk about this stuff when it comes up. But I personally, for me, a lot of it is I developed years ago. It's my Mel Gibson rule, which is essentially that in my mind, Mel Gibson died in a horrible horse riding accident on the set of The Patriot and was replaced by an evil doppelganger. And so anything that he made before The Patriot, I am still willing to watch, but that I am not going to chomp at the bit to watch new stuff that he creates. And that works for me most of the time, but it's not, that's, everybody's got a different. But I always appreciate that you reckon with this stuff because I don't. It's so easy on film Twitter and stuff like that to just be like, oh, this person's canceled. They're dead to me. But that's not the reality. I can't cancel Joss Whedon because I can't take away what Buffy and Angel meant to my life. Like literally Buffy and Angel saved my life at one point in my life. And so it's like, no, I can say that Joss Whedon's a monster and I'll never support anything he does now, but Buffy's in my DNA. I can't take that out. Steven Seagal's in your DNA. No matter how much it may suck, you can't take away what he meant to your life. But we have to reckon with it. And I always love that you do.
Yeah, I appreciate that you do too, because it's like, I agree. It's like, I'm not the person who says, well, this person is bad, so now all of their art they ever created is gone from my life. Like, you know, I don't think that that's wrong, but I just don't think that you have to tell other people to do that. And but on the other hand, I also hate it when I mention this and then people come at me like, can't you separate the art from the artist? This, like as if I shouldn't discuss my feelings about it because I have to pretend that they're fine and great because even as recently as I thought Bloodfather was an awesome movie, and that's long after most people wouldn't watch a Mel Gibson movie. And
I mean, I did still watch it. I'm kind of a hypocrite, right? Because I still did watch Bloodfather, and I'm not gonna lie, I thought it was good.
It's just the reality is like I like those movies, and also I don't like people that do some of the things that he's, things that he represents. And so that's just the reality of it. I'm not going to choose get rid of it or pretend it's great.
Well, shit, I liked Dragged Across Concrete. And I mean, talk about a movie, talk about like cognitive dissonance in film form. A Craig Zoller movie starring Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn is cognitive dissonance for me in film form. I still thought the movie was pretty terrific. You know, I know a lot of other people don't agree, but and I thought it was pretty terrific because it did feel like a movie actually forcing us to reconcile and reckon with those things, because I'm watching Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn be racist assholes, which is like, okay, you know, how do I go about dealing with this? But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, that was a long, that was one of my long tortured reviews, that movie, because it's such a weird combination of like things that I love in movies combined with things that offend me as a human being in one package. So, but yeah, like we said, it's just like, just deal with all of that. And it's like, I can say that it upsets me and also that it's a great movie in a lot of ways.
And everybody's got to make that truth. Everybody's got to make, you know, that's why I never tell people, like, whatever line you decide is your line. And that's all there is to it. It's not my place to tell you what I feel like my obligation is as like the host of this podcast, is to note those problematic elements and warn people. You know, we did, when Lee Golden and I did our review of Max Cloud, there is a, I think, a terribly transphobic joke in that movie. Now, I didn't tell people not to watch the movie. I watched it. I've watched it a couple of times because I think there's a lot of really good stuff in Max Cloud. But I damn sure made sure that people knew that there was a terribly transphobic joke in Max Cloud.
Yeah.
And I sort of figured that's what my job is to give people the heads up and let them make their own decision.
Yeah, I totally agree. But as far as I know, nobody in this Hercules, Legend of Hercules, is what they call it, what the kids call problematic. So
no, I believe we are actually free and clear on this movie. So let's get back to it, because we
just so that we don't imply that Rennie Harlan kidnapped somebody or something.
Correct. And
everything is cool as far as we know.
We were talking about the great Spence Wilding, and that's how we got off on this tangent, because Max Landis, and then we go from there. But anyway.
And then there's the Brett Ratner part. And
yeah. It's like everything around this movie is problematic as shit. But the movie itself, no, it seems to be free and clear. We seem to be good to go. What are any other things you want to talk about before we get into Scott's performance?
I think that's about it.
Let's talk about the man.
It's obviously the best part of the movie.
He's fucking fantastic in this movie. He's having so much fun. And I love the fact that he's only like 7 years older than Kellan Lutz, but they gray his beard, which is so funny because now if you see Scott, he's actually kind of gray, which makes like, for those, obviously it's an audio podcast, you can't see, Scott's pretty much my exact same age, where our birthdays are like 6 weeks apart. I am totally gray, so kudos to him for keeping it going as long as he did. But they gray up his beard and make him look older because, yeah, they're only like 7 years or something like that apart. But
I laughed when it said 20 years later, because I was just like rubbing my hands together waiting to find out how they were going to make Scott Adkins look 20 years older. And then it turned out to be a very manly beard that he had that made him like kind of an evil King Randor.
It's a great beard. It's a great beard that he's got in this movie. Like, this movie has some peak beard, some peak beard use. but he is, again, much like Jonathan Schaech, I think, fully aware of the kind of movie that he's in. He's fully aware of the kind of role that he's supposed to play. It's a live action comic book. He is playing it to the hilt, and I think it's terrific. And I also think that Rennie does a pretty good job of taking advantage of his skills. I mean, we haven't really talked about the fight scenes in this movie, but I think most of them are pretty good. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would say they're, if you went in thinking it was going to be like Boyka, then of course it would be disappointing. But I thought it was cool to see him being able to do this style of like gladiator fight where it's like, he looked so huge and powerful when he's like jumping with the armor and swinging a big heavy sword. And like we mentioned, the speed ramping like did work for making him just seem like this powerful force. He's just like stomping around. And Yeah, and I loved in that first duel with the king at the beginning when he put his sword in the ground and kept fighting against a guy who has a sword without his own sword, like, and defeats him. Like, that was a good badass gesture there.
Yeah, I mean, they hook him up, right? Like, they establish him right out of the gate as a threat and a powerful fighter. And because that was one of my favorite parts, too, because, again, as somebody who has just obsessively watched so many of his movies, when he puts that sword in the ground and does the, like, kind of, like, come on, it's so him. It just, like, yeah. Like, his body movement and everything about it is just so him. And what I really like is, in a lot of ways, this makes a nice, this and his first episode of Metal Hurlong Chronicles, The King's Crown, play very nicely together, because very similar, you know, they were shot around the same time and very similar filmmaking techniques and stuff. And, it's just, he cuts, I think, by and large, I would consider The Rock's Hercules to be the superior movie, but I do not believe that the villain in that movie is anywhere near as good as Scott is in this movie. To be honest with you, I can't even actually remember who the villain is in The Rock's Hercules. I remember Ian McShane, but I don't remember who the villain is.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think I agree with you, except I don't remember who the villain is, so I could be wrong.
Is it Joseph Fiennes? I think it might be Joseph Fiennes. but yeah, maybe, I mean, so. Clearly, like, you know, Scott cuts a very impressive presence in this movie. And for me, it's yet again another one of those things that has been sort of his blessing and his curse throughout his career of getting to be the best part in movies that aren't up to his caliber. You know, I mean, this is a movie that, even though it's got a massive budget, well, massive compared to what he's normally working with, I put this one in the categories with, like, Doctor Strange and even, like, the great ones like Zero Dark Thirty, that are movies with big budgets, but that are actually kind of beneath him in terms of what they're giving him to.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. I was thinking of movies like Criminal. He was in that, right? I actually liked that movie a lot, but it's like one of those ones where you see him just have this small part and you know they're just wasting him, not using him for what he can do. And this was not that. This was like, if you go only for Scott Adkins, maybe you're not going to like it, but you're at least going to be more satisfied than, oh, sorry about the phone there. You'll be, hold on. you'll be more satisfied than with those other ones where he's just like agent number three on the side of the shot or whatever.
Yeah, you're not going to be disappointed. I mean, you might be disappointed if, like you said, if you're expecting Boyka, but you're not going to be disappointed because he's got a meaty role. He's essentially the second lead, and he gets plenty of fight scenes. And I actually think the final fight between him and Kellan Lutz, even though I don't believe for a second that we live in a world where Kellan Lutz could go toes with Scott Adkins and come out anything but with several broken bones, the fight is very good. It's credible. They're both going back and forth. But I also really do just love how much he steers into, you know, and I've talked to him about this, you know, just how much fun. And he's really, I mean, he's played some bad guys in his career, but oof, this might be the baddest. I mean, he is just an absolute monster in this movie, and he steers into it. He's doing it with, and again, I mean this with a compliment, he's like short of, just like this short of twirling his mustache as he's saying his lines. And I think that's awesome. I love that.
Yeah, I think he's, I love that he gets to play such an asshole in it. And he, in subsequent years, has been able to do a version of that that's a lot funnier, which I appreciate. But especially for that point in his career, this is pretty, like, different type of role for him. So it was pretty cool. Like, it takes advantage of talents that he hadn't really shown off as much at that time. And, like, was trying to remember the line that I was laughing at so much when he, when the, that scene where after they had killed the lion, or Hercules had killed the lion and his brother took credit for it and walks in wearing the fur, his delivery of line where he's like, "What is that thing? Take it off." Like, he's just, I just love that it's this, one of the most famous parts of the Hercules legend, and he's just kind of like disgusted by it, and it just made me laugh, his delivery of that.
Yeah, no, he's it's, again, it's, I've said this before, I have yet, and I've seen all but one, I have seen every Scott Adkins movie, most every Scott Adkins TV show in existence, and I stand by this, he is never the worst part of anything that he is in. So regardless of whether you like The Legend of Hercules or not, you may not like it, but it ain't gonna be because of him. He is so much fun in this. And I think that goes back to my biggest problem with the movie. And I feel bad that I continue to kind of bag on Kellan Lutz. But again, looking at Liam McIntyre's performance, because McIntyre's kind of on the same wavelength as Adkins, right? And so I feel like they could have had sort of a scenery chewing off, essentially, if they had been the leads. But Kellan Lutz is just trying, he's trying so hard to be the stoic hero. You know, this is his Marvel edition, or audition, essentially, is what he's trying to do here. And
he gets to do a big Braveheart speech, too.
Yeah. And, you know, and I will give him this. He doesn't do a bad job with the Braveheart speech. And
yeah, I agree.
And one thing that I will say about him, he did the work. Like, you watch the action scenes with him, he did the work. He clearly put the time in the gym and with the stunt coordinators and stuff like that. He did the work. He's not lazing his way through this movie. It's not his fault that there are other people like Scott Adkins and Spence Wilding and stuff like that that are just, that this is what they do, is action movies. That's not Kellan Lutz's fault. He put the work in. I will never begrudge him that, because I have seen plenty of movies where people don't do the work. Bruce Willis. And you know, and say what you will, Kellan Lutz did the work.
Yeah. There was a movie called Arena that he starred in that was like the only time I've seen it, like an action vehicle for him. And I remember that I liked it, but I don't actually remember much about it. Or I liked him in it. So there was a little bit there where he was going for earning his place on the Expendables 3 team.
Yeah. That was, I never saw Arena, but I know that there are some people like you that actually have some pretty, you know, and I will say this. I do feel sorry for the Twilight kids. I mean, I actually don't. One of my things I'm going to do this year is do a full rewatch of Twilight, because I had a lot of, I think, unnecessarily harsh opinions on that series. And so I kind of want to rewatch them. And I do feel sorry for a lot of the Twilight kids, because I think a lot of them, they sort of got this weird, like, kind of typecast, and it's not necessarily fair to them. Some of them are very bland. You know, I was just talking the other day to somebody about Kellan Lutz, and they brought up Cam Gigandet. Is the same thing, just a very bland white guy. And it did make me kind of realize that maybe I'm being a little too harsh on Kellan Lutz, because I actually love, as a guy who loves Never Back Down, I have a lot, I don't care about Cam Gigandet from Twilight, but as the bad guy in Never Back Down,
he was fun in that.
He's fucking great in that movie. And so, you know, it's like, I do think I'm being a bit unnecessarily harsh, and we've all been unnecessarily harsh, I think, to the Twilight kids. Like, look at how good, you know, Robert Pattinson and Kirsten Stewart are now, right?
I know,
like,
I think people realize that by now, but it's just those two are both such movie stars, because they, in the sense of, like, they can take a movie like Underwater or one of those and just, like, just through their charisma make it so much more interesting. And then at the same time, both of them are really interested in working in all these kind of more art house Indian foreign directors and interesting people. And they're definitely they've done the best that you could with the clout that they gained from that.
Yeah. Series. I mean, I have to admit, I kind of avoided watching Underwater because, again, a problematic cast member in that movie. But when I did finally watch it, damn, that's a good movie. And Kristen Stewart.
And she's really just so cool.
Good
right? in it.
She's yeah. so good. And she and Vincent Cassel, who I love. I love Vincent Cassel to death as an mm-hmm. actor. They have such great chemistry as sort of this, like, you know, I love, it's not a rom. It's not even remotely romantic. It's just more like a mentor mentee or just a deep affection. Like if folks listening, if you haven't watched Underwater, fucking watch Underwater. It's terrific. But the other one that I always think of with that is Ashley Greene, because, you know, she came into Twilight and she's very pretty. And then kind of just, she got a lot of crap. And, you know, I see her in Accident Man and she's going to be co-starring with Scott again in One Shot. And that just makes me happy. Like, more power to her. I hope all the Twilight folks manage to have long, successful careers without, you know, people, grumps like me, constantly trying to trash them, which I'm trying to be a better person about stuff.
Well, yeah. I watched those movies way after the fact, and I think that was the perfect thing to do because it was like everyone was kind of getting over them, and then I watched them, and I was able to just say, like, you know, these are goofy and laugh about it, but not take it personally the way some horror fans do of, like, this can't be the future of horror or whatever they're concerned about. I think they're fun movies. There's a lot of things that are really good about them, and then there's a lot of the stuff that's bad about them is really entertaining to me. So, you know, I watched them all. I pretty much marathoned them all, and I enjoyed the experience. So I'm for it. I'm pro Twilight.
Well, and there's some stuff that as a kid, you know, as an old man from Utah, you know, for those who don't know, the Stephanie Moore, the writer of Twilight, is of the dominant faith here in Utah. And there are some things growing up in Utah I find problematic. Yeah, but that's inherent in the source material. That's not the movie's fault, right? Like, it's not fair to blame the movies. I will say, to just give a little bit of credit to Kellan Lutz, he is in a romantic comedy that came out in 2011 that has a terrible Metacritic score, but I actually kind of enjoy. My wife and I watched it, and we kind of enjoyed it. It's called Love, Wedding, Marriage, with him and Mandy Moore, and then it co-stars James Brolin and Jane Seymour. It's... It's fine, and I will say that's part of, I think, the problem. Kellan Lutz wanted to be an action guy. Like, I remember reading interviews with him where he wanted to be an action guy, and he is much better as a romantic comedy guy, I think, than he is as an action guy. So he probably would have been better to go that route. But anyway, enough me bagging on Kellan Lutz. He's fine. He's fine. He's fine in the
movie. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, Vern, we've been going for a little bit more than an hour. Anything else you want to add about The Legend of Hercules?
I want to say that at the end, when he's standing on the wall looking at the moon, it reminded me of the end of 1989 Batman when he stands up looking at the bat signal.
I'm going to give Rennie credit. There's some seriously cool iconography in this movie. Like he shoots some cool... Like, he hooks Kellan Lutz up with looking like a god in this movie. There's some very cool stuff. I love that scene. And we mentioned the other one. I love the scene when he's pulling the chains out of the stone and just the way that you get the overhead camera shot as he's looking up and screaming at the sky. Like, there's some very cool shots in this movie.
And the opening, like, the part that was obviously, we got to do a bunch of 3D stuff here at the beginning. Like, that was really cool looking too. Like, zooming through this big battle with arrows flying around and stuff. I liked that.
So, anything else you want to add?
Nope.
All right. So, Vern, would you or would you not? I always ask this. So, just as a general, would you recommend Legend of Hercules for Adkins? Like, would you consider it recommend for fans only, or just don't even recommend at all? Where would you sort of rank this one?
I would say recommend to either fans of this genre or to fans of Scott Adkins, as long as they note that it has a 5% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I don't normally go by Rotten Tomatoes at all, but just I think that sets your expectations that like it's clearly way better than 5% good. So if you set your expectations at that, then I recommend it.
Yeah, I remember when I reached out to you and I asked you, you know, teaser for everybody listening, Vern is going to be back. We're going to talk Savage Dog, which I think is a movie that we are going to have a whole lot more to talk about than this one, because that one is a movie that I really want to tear into. I think there's a lot going on in that movie. But I also said, well, if you want to come on sooner, you can do Hercules. I'm sorry. And you agreed to do it. And this is one of the reasons why, like, sometimes you got to watch a movie more than once, because I was going into this absolutely expecting, knowing the one-star Letterboxd review, to just be like, nope, this is right up there with, you know, the worst of the worst Adkins movies. It's a not recommend. And no, sorry, it's a recommend. I think it's fun. I think it's, I mean, again, it's, I think 5% Rotten Tomatoes, which again, we don't usually go by Rotten Tomatoes because of how their scoring system works. It's not a 5% Rotten Tomatoes movie. It's a solid 2.5 star movie. If you know what you're getting into, there's a lot of fun to be had here. I think it's a little slow in parts. I think the second act really bogs down a bit. I think it starts strong and it ends really strong. So I would say if you haven't seen it, check it out. Like it's worth checking out, especially if you're an Adkins fan, because you're going to miss out on one of what I think is his funnest, most interesting, most entertaining performances if you're not watching this one.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So Vern, normally I ask people to make some recommendations for Scott Adkins movies. But since I'm going to have you back on for Savage Dog, I think I kind of want to save that for that conversation. Not to mention it's like your Vern, folks, just go to outlawvern.com and read his reviews. You'll know his recommendations. But you mentioned that you in particular like these kind of, and I'm putting you on the spot here, so I understand if you're not going to have anything right off the top of your head, but you mentioned, and you talked about some earlier, you like these kind of goofy fantasy movies. Give me three fantasy movies like this that you would recommend people listening should check out.
Okay, well, we already mentioned 300 Rise of an Empire, but I think it's worth bringing up again because a lot of people just skipped that one or ignored it and just assumed it was bad. And I admittedly, the star of the movie is not as charismatic as Gerard Butler. So I understand people have a problem with that, but it has so much more going on, and the geography of the battles and the fights are so cool. And Eva Green plays this villainess who is, you know, she can chew the scenery like nobody, and you're enjoying her. And then you find out her backstory, and then at least if you're like me, you start going, I think I'm rooting for her. She actually deserves to be the victor here. Yeah, you know.
And I do want to also mention, again, tying it back into Strike Back, the lead is Sullivan Stapleton from Strike Back. This is a very Strike Back heavy episode. He is not as entertaining as Gerard Butler, but I do love the relationship that he has with Eva Green in this movie. They're sort of very John Woo dynamic that ultimately leads to it. I mean, I think it's fair to say fairly hot sex scene in the movie, weird, but, you know, but a very John Woo dynamic of hero villain, but not necessarily hero villain. I can't second this recommendation more. I love Rise of an Empire.
Yeah. And the structure of it is really clever, the way that it's like a prequel, but it also overlaps with the original. And I think it goes past the original. I forget exactly how it works, but
it does. It goes along. So it starts before, goes along, and then ends, because it's the end for Greek history nerds. It essentially ends with the Battle of Salamis when, you know, the Athenians beat the Persians. So we get sort of the whole Peloponnesian War in kind of one movie, where 300, you know, would almost slot into like a 10-minute segment in the middle of the movie, which I think, you know, a lot of ways makes it more interesting too.
Yeah. And then another one I would say is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, the Guy Ritchie movie, which, you know, maybe a more normal person might just want a straightforward King Arthur movie. But to me, it was great because it's such a insane version of it. And people don't believe me when I tell them that it opens with giant elephant monsters with pyramids on their back battling each other. And it's not, it's not as crazy as that through most of it, but then it gets weird in different ways where it's like very much is a Guy Ritchie movie with all of the tropes of like the group of lads who all have their nicknames for each other and have different specialties and stuff. It's all like very kind of silly and fun in the way that it's fitting modern ideas into a King Arthur story. And so like there's a what's his name, Littlefinger is the sniper who's like, he's an archer, and he but they treat him as being like a military sniper because he like comes out with a blanket and unrolls it and puts together his bow and arrow and has to like shoot from a tower to try to assassinate a person at a certain time. And so it just has all these aspects that I think are stand out from others of the genre because it's just trying to do ridiculous things. And it also has an amazing score that it's like, a lot of it is like organic instrumentation, but playing in a way that seems kind of inspired by electronic music. And that's a fun movie that didn't get enough credit, I think.
Aidan Gillen. I just looked him up.
Aidan Gillen. Thank you. I'm sorry. I know everyone knows that, but
I'm so glad you mentioned the score, because so for me, I was only kind of okay on this movie, except for one thing. There is and this isn't really a spoiler, there is a montage where Arthur is growing up with all the lads, like you said, and he's learning how to pick pockets and stuff. And the way that montage is cut to, so one of my favorite film composers is Daniel Pemberton. I think he might be the best composer working in movies right now. And the score that he puts to that montage, that like 10-minute scene, is one of the most deliriously entertaining 10 minutes of a movie that I think I've ever seen in my life. And so I will always have nothing but affection for King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. Even though I don't think everything in the movie works, that alone is such a bravura display of what Guy Ritchie does when Guy Ritchie is firing on all cylinders, that I continually recommend the movie to people just for that. I'm just like, just for that montage, like watch the rest of the movie because there's other good stuff in it. But that montage alone is going to make you like this movie because it's 10 minutes of cinematic perfection. I absolutely love it. So I'm glad you brought that one up too. Give me one more.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I like, since I like the generic version of this type of movie, which I would say Legends of Hercules pretty much represents, then I love the, like, this is the completely insane person version of that, where it's kind of a modern gangster movie / modern military movie combined with a King Arthur movie combined with a movie where there's giant elephants that fight each other. You know?
I mean, it's only Guy Ritchie, right? Like, say what you will about Guy Ritchie, but only Guy Ritchie could make that movie. And I'm never gonna completely hate a movie where I see it and I go, well, you know, we were just talking about way back at the start of how I can't really say what is a Rennie Harlan movie. I can watch King Arthur, Legend of the Sword and go, well, that's a fucking Guy Ritchie movie. Like, there's no exactly. question that's a Guy Ritchie movie. And that's awesome. I will always appreciate, even if I don't like, I will always appreciate that.
Yeah, that's well put. It's just, you know, I don't want to see the version where he wastes his time making a normal version of it. You know, I just want to see the version where he puts his stamp on it, and that's totally what he did. And then for a third one, I guess I would say this is a little older, but there's a movie called Wolfhound, which is a Russian movie. And it's kind of in the vein of, I think it's based on a famous Russian book series maybe, and I don't know too much about it, but it's kind of in the vein of Conan as being this kind of buff warrior guy who, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I think he like escapes from slavery and all those sort of mythical things. And one thing that I loved about it is that he has a pet bat whose name, if I remember right, is Ragged Wing, because he has an injured wing. And I always think about that movie that everybody hated, Your Highness, which I thought was pretty funny, but there was some joke about how everyone has an animal companion. All the fantasy characters have an animal companion, which probably comes from Beastmaster, which I enjoy too. But I respect Wolfhound and his animal companion, Ragged Wing.
So I don't remember if it was, I think I found your review of Wolfhound. You'd linked it to another review, and it's been on my watch list for years, and I still haven't watched it yet, and I now feel shame. I feel shame for not having watched it, because
I think in general, all of these movies, with maybe the exception of 300 Rise of an Empire, is the best of the ones that I've mentioned, but all of them have plenty of things wrong with them, and they're not like great movies, but it's just like kind of like a, I think of them as being like a fun Saturday afternoon type of movie that I just makes me happy.
Well, I mean, those are the movies we watch, right? Like as guys who do DTV stuff and action movies, like very few are Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning. Like exactly. Most of them are ones that are always going to have flaws, but is there enough? Legend of Hercules is a perfect example. Is there enough to make it worth watching? And I would say, yeah, look, I've now seen Legend of Hercules twice. I doubt I will watch it a third time, but you never know. I might get a bug up my ass. I'm sure at some point I'm going to get a bug up my ass to do another Adkins rewatch and just sit down and be like, I'm just going to start at Special Forces, and I'm going to start at Accidental Spy, and I'm going to go all the way through again. It's going to be rough when I get to Zero Tolerance again, but that is what it is. And that's the thing, is it's like, is there enough? And are they interesting? Do they do something interesting? And I will say, at least I think King Arthur does interest, or not King Arthur, Legend of Hercules does interesting things, and it sounds like Wolfhound does interesting things. So I need to just get off my ass and watch it. That's all there is to it. I'm spending too much time watching Adkins movies now, unfortunately. So, all right, Vern, thank you so much, man. This was a blast. I had a great time talking this movie with you. I'm so excited to have you come back and do Savage Dog, because I really think we're going to have just a lot to say about that one. But plug some shit. I can't imagine that anybody listening to this doesn't know where to find you, but just in case, plug some shit. Where can people find you?
Well, I'm at outlawvern.com. I review almost every week. I review 4 movies, and I specialize in action and horror. Like, those are my favorites, but I do all kinds of random stuff. I'm on Twitter at also outlawvern, and on Patreon and Letterboxd, which I'm pretty new to. So if you follow me, I would appreciate that if you want to. And then I want to plug I wrote a horror novel. It's a horror action novel called Worm on a Hook. And it's basically like combining the tropes of slasher movies with the tropes of like Seagal and Van Damme type movies that I love. And so it's got a masked killer in the woods, but it also has like underground martial arts fights and exploding helicopters and just like Seagalogy, there's absurdity to it. And I think I hope there's a lot of funny stuff in it, but it's a serious story, and I'm very proud of it. So you can look that up on Amazon. If you search Worm on a Hook, Vern, you'll find it.
And I have not read it, but I've heard nothing but great things about it. I am going to link it in the show notes. Is linking to the Amazon page the best way to link to it, or should I link? Are you selling them yourself? What's the best way for people to buy this that's going to give you the most amount of money?
I could give you a link with an affiliate code on it.
Perfect. Just DM me that, and I will make sure that I use that as the link in the show notes so that people can get it. And I'll make sure to also link outlawvern.com, your Twitter, and your Letterboxd, so that everybody can follow you there. Please, 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 folks, I literally cannot impress upon you. You're not listening to this show without Vern. Like, this show does not exist without Vern. So if you're not already following him, please, please think about your life choices and rectify that mistake, because he is, I do podcasts because I can't write as well as you, to be honest with you. And I can talk, but I don't. I will never enjoy a review more than the one that you usually do for a movie. Even if I disagree with you, I will always be like, yep, nope, Vern, because you always get it. Even if you don't like a movie, you still get it. And there have been some that I've disagreed with you on, but I'm still like, well, I can't fault the criticisms. I don't necessarily agree with them. So you are one of my favorite writers, one of my favorite reviewers. Everybody listening, please make sure to follow him. I can't thank him enough for being here tonight. It actually has been truly an honor, my friend, to actually get to talk to you about this.
Well, thank you very much. And it honestly is a big honor for me to be here too. I really love your podcast, and I think you've done a great job. And I love all the research that you do and how seriously you take this. So thank you very much for this podcast and for having me on it.
Thank you, my friend. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too.
And that will do it for this week's show. Thanks again to Vern for joining me, and thanks as always to Scott for taking time to talk to me. You can follow the show at Adkins Podcast on Twitter or Adkins Undisputed on Instagram, and you can find links to the show at linktree.com/AdkinsUndisputedPod. You can also find my work with Dana Buckler at linktree.com/DanaBucklerShow, where we talk about all sorts of movies, almost none of them Scott Adkins related. Next week, we go back to China for the first time since The Medallion as we talk one of the biggest Chinese franchises of all time in Wolf Warrior, and of course, we have to talk Wolf Warrior 2. Joining me for that will be next week's champion, the amazing, unbelievable Alex Rayo, aka One Perfect Headshot on Twitter. I'm super excited for you guys to hear this one. So until then, bring your ears, your podcast app of choice, and your fucking champion to Adkins Undisputed, the most complete Scott Adkins podcast in the world.